Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new intelligent medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to DearHoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to DearHoffman.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're continuing our discussion with Mark Schatzker, who's author of a great new book, The Dorito Effect, The Surprising New Truth About Food and Flavor. And Mark, is there a website that people can go to get information about this?
Yes, markschatzker.com is my website. I have updates and that kind of a thing.
Okay, so it's S-C-H-A-T-Z-K-E-R. And with apologies, because there's some sirens in the background, but hey, that's the reality of New York radio. Okay, so it gives it an authentic, kind of an aura of authenticity. Or maybe that's just one of the people who, had too many Doritos and is, headed for the ER. Could be. I'm just a victim of, precisely the phenomenon you're talking about. Okay, so in your book, you talk about something very interesting, and I didn't realize there was such a thing. It's amazing when you check it out. It's called the Yale Food Addiction Scale, and the public can actually dial this in, and you can do the questionnaire. It's a self-administered questionnaire, and you can find out where you are on the spectrum of food addiction, right?
Yes, and it's really interesting, because what it does is it describes food addictive behavior. So this taking this questionnaire doesn't tell you what your BMI is, but it does inform you if your eating is getting into a kind of a behavioral rut that can be problematic. It's a very distressing thing to read, to be honest. There's these questions, the questionnaire is like, I fail to control my eating, once a day, twice a day, three or more times a day. I find that eating is interrupting my relationships with loved ones and work colleagues. Yeah. And it just goes on and on, and it's quite distressing to realize. I mean, I don't suffer from those problems, and it's sad to realize that so many people are having such a dysfunctional relationship with food, which, let's face it, it's supposed to make you live, right?
Right. But, this is thought to be a moral failing, or the result of laziness, sloth, avarice, greed, the gluttony. And yet, there are forces at play in industry that militate towards this, that encourage us to fall into these patterns.
Yes, and I think it's unfair to look at it that way, to say that, like you say, sloth and laziness and so forth. I think many of these people are dealing with some real problems. The thing that's so interesting to me is that if you look at the obesity curve over the last 40 years, it's gotten worse across the board. At the extreme end, those people are falling into what we would call food addiction. But even the overweight struggle with cravings, and there's many, many more obese than there used to be. I think we've created food that is getting us into this pattern of cravings that can't be satisfied by food.
Yeah, I think it was Marion Nestle or another prominent nutritionist who talked about the obesogenic environment, an environment that, it's like air pollution. It's food pollution. It's our environment is
That's
causing
right.
us.
It's not our genes. We know that our genes have not changed. It's something in our environment. And the one thing we haven't looked at is flavor. And flavor, as I argue, has changed enormously, not only with this hyper-incentivized junk food, but also the fact that real food is getting blander, which is a real problem.
Yeah, your quote is, everything wrong with food comes down to the way it tastes, either on the bland side or on the over-revved side, I guess is what you're talking about.
You know what I would say is this. We've been focused on finding the nutritional culprit for like half a century, and it keeps bouncing around. Sugar, fat, carbs, sugar, this kind of fat, that kind of fat. The interesting thing to me is that back in the 1960s, when we were relatively trim, all those things existed. It's not as though we invented sugar in 1982. The question is, why did we eat less back then? And we have to stop approaching food as a nutritional, physiological interaction. That definitely happens. When food gets in your stomach, it starts to have an effect on your body. But the obesity is a behavioral problem. The question is, why are we doing it? Maybe a better way to understand it is through the lens of smoking. If you ask people, why is smoking deadly? they will say, well, because it causes cancer. But the real reason smoking kills so many people is because it's addictive. It's because the behavior of smoking, repeated over years, that's how the cancer happens. The reason we know cigarettes are a problem is because they're addictive. If they weren't addictive, no one would smoke.
You, in part one, you ran down the devolution of the chicken, you know, the chicken that was once tasty, robust, and nutritious, but less suitable for industrial mass production. You actually have a pretty good section of the book talking about the demise of the tomato.
Yes. Yeah, the tomato, well, there's a lot of science on the tomato, and that's one of the reasons I focused on it so much, because we know so much about what we've done to it. The tomato, like the chicken, we've cranked up the production unbelievably. We produce so many more tomatoes now per acre of land than we did 50 years ago. In the course of doing that, we've essentially ruined the tomato. The shelf life is great, the yield is great, but we've completely lost flavor. There's a few reasons for that. One reason is that there's just too many tomatoes on an individual plant now, and a plant essentially experiences the plant equivalent of a brownout. There's not enough leaves. It cannot photosynthesize enough energy to adequately feed all those fruits. So it just sort of fills those tomatoes with water, and that's what they taste like. But on an even more fundamental level, the modern tomato has forgotten how to be delicious. Because every time we've bred for these other traits, for shelf life, for disease resistance, for yield, we have not selected flavor. And when you don't select for something, you lose it. It's reverse evolutionary pressure. The tomato lost flavor for the same reason that we lost our tails. And it's gone. There's nothing you can do to make a modern tomato taste good. I mean, even if you grow it in the richest, most lovingly tended garden, you can't get these things to taste good because the DNA for flavor is gone.
And also, people point to the loss of biological diversity. You know, we used to have, literally scores of different types of potatoes where they originated in the Andes, each with specific characteristics. They were purple. They were, ranging, a full spectrum of colors. And it all resulted in the, in what we now use, the big Idaho potato, or the potatoes that they use to chop into French fries here in America.
Yeah, we have very little potato diversity here. It's really too bad. I've been to South America, and the potatoes down there are incredible. They've got potatoes that are completely different. We wouldn't even recognize them. And it's unfortunate that we're denying ourselves these pleasures, because not only are these potatoes, do they taste different, but they're filled with all sorts of fascinating organic compounds, some of which have healthful properties. There's a group at the University of Idaho. There's a USDA lab there where they're doing some really interesting work with potatoes. And they developed some purple potatoes that they did a very good study. They found that it had a positive impact on people with hypertension, on blood sugar, these anthocyanins, these plant compounds. So when people talk about there's healthful attributes in these fruits and vegetables, there absolutely are. I don't want to overstress it and say it's like it's a miracle cure. But when you eat a diet like that, it all adds up to something that's truly good for you.
Yeah, ultimately, you eat less, and it's more concentrated in healthy nutrients.
Exactly.
So, but look, the devil's advocate argument here is, you got your exclusive, grass, range-fed chickens, natural chickens. It took months and months to make them. They ended up weighing 2.5 pounds. Making, these artisanal tomatoes might be fine for hedge fund managers who can pay $6 per tomato. But what about feeding the planet? That's why we've gotten into our agricultural chemistry to create abundance.
That's a great question, and that's something that really troubled me. When I set out to write this book and started doing the research, I really didn't like where it was going because I realized that flavor is expensive, and it's very troubling to me to think of a world where only a certain thin upper wafer of society gets to enjoy these foods that are not only delicious but nutritious and satisfying, and everyone else has to, eat the cardboard, highly seasoned crap. That really bugged me, but it turns out that's actually not the situation. We should be very excited about the future. And I'll talk about it in two ways. The first is the tomato. It turns out, as I mentioned, the problem with the tomato is that we've lost the DNA, the instructions for flavor. We can get them back. In fact, we already have it back. There's a professor of horticulture at the University of Florida who did something really interesting. This guy knows more about flavor in tomatoes than arguably anyone in the world. And he crossed a modern commercial tomato with the best tasting heirloom tomato he'd ever grown. And he was just sort of hoping for an above average tomato, decent yield, decent disease resistant, decent flavor. What he got was a miracle tomato. The yield is about 85% as good as the best performing modern tomato. So you get a good crop from these things. The disease resistance is superb. So farmers can grow this thing without worrying that their crops can get totally wiped out. And the flavor is so good, his taste panels could not taste the difference between it and its heirloom parent. So we can produce delicious tomatoes that don't cost an arm and a leg. Will they cost 99 cents a pound? No, but it might be $1.39 a pound, which I think the vast majority of us can afford and will be inclined to pay for, because they're going to taste great. And they're going to spend a lot less money on ranch dressing because these tomatoes won't need it. Well, chicken...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, so you're seeing an inflection point in our current food supply as food technologists address the question, you know, we made so much progress towards shelf life and towards, productivity and hitting the price point. And now there may be a renaissance in food technology where we're really trying to reacquire some of the attributes we lost in our rush towards progress.
We just need to get flavor back, and we can do it. And what we need to do as consumers is put pressure on, basically say, I want these things. I want my grapes to taste better. I want my cucumbers to taste better. I want my tomatoes to taste better. And they'll give it to us. They'll follow the money. Money is a great incentive. It'll get people to do it. Now, you also asked about chicken, and chicken is a little bit different. We cannot produce a tasty chicken for the same price that we produce a cardboard chicken. But it also doesn't have to be as expensive as it was in the 1940s. In the 1940s, a chicken cost about $3, which is almost $30 in today's standards. That's a lot of money for a chicken.
Yeah.
But in France, they have a grade of chicken called La Belle Rouge, which is a chicken as you might expect it's raised on a farm. These chickens get to go outside. They get to peck around and eat grasshoppers and leaves and blades of grass and all that good stuff. And they, by law, they must be a minimum of 84 days before they're sold versus 35 days for a commercial chicken. Well, La Belle Rouge chickens are more expensive. They're not ridiculously expensive, but check this out. In France, which I'll remind you has a smaller GDP per capita than the United States, La Belle Rouge chickens occupy more than half of the market for whole chickens. These are big sellers. It's big business. The market for La Belle Rouge chickens is worth more than €1 billion. So this is not just foofy food for the ultra rich. This is food that a lot of people can enjoy. The other thing I'd say is if you buy a really delicious chicken, like I said, you don't eat as much of it. You can have the breasts one night and then make a soup with the legs, and that flavor, it is so rich and it goes so far that you kind of get more out of it. So we have to be more tuned into quality than just merely looking at quantity and saying, oh, that chicken's on sale for $6. I'm buying it. Right. You know, we all buy nice cell phones. We all pay a little bit more for like a nicer hotel room or a nicer car. Why does everyone think they should buy the cheapest food? I mean, it's going in their body.
Well, the concern is, you know, as you point out in the book, is that perhaps some of us have reached the point of no return. You know, our taste buds are so jaded by these jazzed up artificial flavors that it's kind of like how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Gay Paris when it comes to these accentuated tastes? How can we recover our taste buds? You actually describe that process a little bit personally in the book.
I think you absolutely can. My own palate changed. I used to drink my coffee with cream and sugar. I stopped using sugar, not because I was trying to lose weight. I've always been a fairly skinny person. One day I just stopped wanting it. I thought, I can't really taste the coffee. All I'm getting is sugar. It tasted like syrup. The more you expose yourself to these foods, the more your palate changes. I used to be an occasional junk food eater. I'm not anymore, not because I'm on some purity kick. I just don't like the stuff. I don't like the way it makes me feel, and I don't really like the flavor anymore. So you can re-educate your palate by exposing yourself to good food. I used to hate broccoli and Brussels sprout. Made me gag. I love them now. my palate has changed as my body has changed. I think what people need to do is, A, buy whole foods that are actually flavorful, that can actually talk to your body and taste good, and stop eating the food that's fooling them. And I think it's not going to happen overnight, but over time, it does change.
You summarize some of those tips in a section in your book, How to Live Long and Eat Flavorfully. So what are some of the tips that you want to impart to people? And obviously, to get the full extent of that, please buy the book and read the book. But what are some of the things you want?
Some of the tips, I would say, very simply, if you want to avoid foods that are sort of fooling your palate, look for the words artificial flavor or natural flavor. There's nothing natural about natural flavor. It is every bit as synthetic and contrived as artificial flavor. When you see those ingredients on foods, it's telling you that the flavor was created by a human in a lab and not by nature. Be wary of those foods. They're in a lot of places, and people will be really shocked. It's not just in potato chips and soft drinks. It's everywhere.
And a lot of health foods, too. You know, if you go to Whole Foods, you know, the chip aisle after chip aisle and dessert aisle after dessert aisle, and these are, quote, natural, but they also induce you to eat more.
And you know, it's in yogurt now. Everyone thinks yogurt is such a great food, but we've turned yogurt into, like, a dessert topping. It's incredibly sweet, right. Highly fruit-flavored, and I don't actually like it. I think it's too sweet. I feel like I'm eating melted ice cream or something. But kids love it, and I think this is a problem. But what people don't realize is when you add fruit flavoring to yogurt, it gives the yogurt company a reason to not put fruit in the yogurt or just put a little bit of fruit. Now, if you look really hard, you can find a yogurt that does not have any flavoring in it. And it's a very different yogurt. It actually tastes like yogurt with just a bit of fruit. I think it's delicious. It's not so cloyingly sweet.
If you want the fruit, add your own fruit. You know, add your own fruit if you want the fruit.
Add your own fruit, exactly. So the other thing I would say is eat for flavor. Eat like one of those passionate Italian chefs who's constantly in search of the most perfect eggplant, the most wonderful tomato. Approach every meal like that, and the act of cooking becomes incredibly satisfying. Your family loves it. You feel better. And over time, junk food just loses its power over you because you just realize it's a cheap thrill.
So can your book actually help people to lose weight?
I think it can. I didn't write this as a diet book, but I would use these examples. The two countries in the world that are the most obsessed with flavor are Japan and Italy. I visited both countries. The food is unbelievable. You have to try hard to have a bad meal, and the people are much skinnier than they are here. I feel real food is more nourishing and more satisfying. I just think it's hard to eat too much of it. I don't want to make any claims about lose 40 pounds in 2 weeks. Those things tend not to ever be true. But I think if people ate a diet that was delicious in a way nature intended, they couldn't help but eat well.
So what's today's intelligent medicine call to action? First of all, the book, The Dorito Effect, The Surprising New Truth About Food and Flavor. You can get it from the usual sources. And then there's a website as well where people can find out more about it. And that is
markschatzker.com.
Yeah, www.markschatzker.com?
Correct.
Okay, great. What will people find there? What sort of resources are available there?
I have some links on where they can find the book. I have news updates. What I'm going to start to do is populate it with links to foods that I like, things that I recommend. Hey, you might want to try this chicken producer. This person does great beef. Here's this yogurt I was talking about. So people can... I want to reward the people that are doing it right. I mean, I'm not against all food companies, and I think if we send the right signals to food companies, they're going to give us the food that we want.
Well, absolutely. You know, and I really commend you because the book is honest. It's scientifically based. It's not offering a phony promise of miracle weight loss. But it really speaks to a fundamental solution to the problem of poor nutrition and overnutrition. Simultaneously, paradoxically, we have both in this country, the Dorito Effect, a surprising new truth about food and flavor. So congratulations, and I hope you have a very, very successful media tour, and you get the word out to the American
public.
Well,
I hope every interview is as good as this one. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.